Good morning. It's Thursday, March 16th, and this is the Cable Morning News. I'm Carlos Chavez.
I'm Chris Andre.
Coming up on this program, thousands of protesters in Ecuador called for an end to free trade talks with the U.S. PGE asks for a rate increase of 8.9%. Part 3 of KBOO News Special on the war industry in Oregon. Weather for today, Portland area weather, rain, highs 45 to 50. Tonight, showers likely with lows 35 to 40. The time is 7:01.
Portland General Electric yesterday asked state regulators for an overall rate increase of 8.9%, according to the Oregonian. It is the first significant jump in 5 years, and one certain to fuel controversies surrounding Oregon's largest utility. PGE said rising power costs and a new natural gas-fired power plant are the main reasons behind the request. But customer groups and City of Portland officials immediately questioned whether the size of the increase is excessive. Under PGE's proposal, which was filed Wednesday with the State Public Utilities Commission, the rate increase would vary by customer class. Rates for residential customers would rise on average of 8.5%. Rates for small commercial customers, 10.5%. And rates for large commercial and industrial businesses, 8.7%. The increases, if approved by the PUC, would go into effect January 1, 2007. Months of negotiations among regulators. The utility customer groups received the PUC's decision changes are often made during the 8-month process. The increases would generate $143 million annually, expanding total ratepayer revenue to $1.6
billion. Portland City Commissioners have voted to subpoena financial documents of PGE as part of an investigation into the utility's rates. Commissioners say if the investigation confirms their suspicions of inflated rates, they are prepared to exercise a never-used state law. It would lower rates for the city's 200,000 Portland General Electric customers. City Commissioner Randy Leonard criticized the utility for failing to voluntarily relinquish the information. PGE spokesman Scott Sims told the Oregonian that the city does not have the authority to examine the documents. PGE Sims says will fight the subpoena. Portland and PGE have been battling over income taxes sent to Enron, which declared bankruptcy in 2001. Commissioners remain unconvinced that PGE sent all the collected taxes to Enron.
Oregon's economic stake in war is higher than it's been since World War II. The growing nanotechnology industry is emerging as a key source for huge U.S. Defense Department grants to businesses around the state. All this week, KBOO News, along with the Portland Alliance newspaper, airs the results of a 3-month investigation into how much our national addiction to war influences our state. Here's part 3 of the series with KBOO's Lisa Loving.
On December 22, 2005, U.S. Senators Gordon Smith, a Republican, and Ron Wyden, a Democrat, announced that Oregon would receive $67.3 million in Defense Department contracts relating to nanotechnology research and development. Both Smith and Wyden declined numerous interview requests for this series. However, U.S. Representative Darlene Hooley did give a brief definition of nanotechnology and its role in Oregon's future.
And then on nanotechnology, the state has said, we want this to be the centerpiece of new research, and it's a cooperative effort between the universities. It's located at in Corvallis at Oregon State. But it is, how do you do lots of things with little tiny, tiny things is what nanotechnology is all about. And it has, again, military applications, but it has applications for our everyday life.
Brian Bogart, a graduate student and researcher in peace studies at the University of Oregon, says there's more to it than that. Nanotech figures prominently in the U.S. military's future war strategy.
Part of that strategy involves something called reachback, which means remote control of every aspect of war, including human soldiers. And that's where nanotechnology comes in. Nanotechnology is a wonderful science. It could be used to clean up the world and give us all alternative energy and health care and all kinds of things. But in the United States, nanotechnology and all the other sciences are funneled through the Department of Defense first, and the public gets benefits later on after people have died.
Smith & Wyden's December nanotechnology press release lists 23 separate projects and their new Defense Department grants. The projects include research into cures for the Ebola and Marburg viruses and the HemCon hemorrhage control bandage. Also included in the nanotech cash flow is $2 million to the University of Oregon's Brain, Biology, and Machine Science Initiative for interdisciplinary research related to cognitive neuroscience, genetics research, and informatics. Much of this research is directed towards optimizing performance by military personnel. For example, allowing a soldier to continue fighting without sleep for a week or after an injury by blocking brain receptors from registering pain using microchips implanted in the brain. Bogart's analysis on U.S. war spending goes back to the 19th century. But he pegs the birth of the military-industrial complex during the presidency of Harry S. Truman.
Just after World War II, our industries faced a second depression. The military industry in particular was crashing, and they came begging our federal government for help. And so secretly, the Truman administration enshrined the arms industry as our economic engine. Instead of human progress, they decided to make corporate profit the backbone of America. And ever since then, we've been reproducing conflicts around the world in order to feed our economic machine. The United States basically runs on conflict around the world.
Dave Mazza, editor of the Portland Alliance, has spent several years researching where the war money goes in our local economy and the difficulty in shutting off that cash flow.
But what we do have is this new facet of what we call the warfare state, which is a real weaving in of defense needs with the broader economy to the point where sometimes it's almost difficult to tell where defense dollars are going. So you have a company that may be providing a new type of bandage that fire bureaus can use with their emergency technicians that stops hemorrhaging quickly. And that's their primary market. But they're now also selling to the military for use in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's easy to say, okay, we know this plant is making tanks, and we want to convert it to building refrigerators and washing machines. But in many cases now, the defense dollars are spread out in a way that, you know, to cut those dollars off suddenly would have a real jolt on our economy, a real downturn. And how we would, you know, compensate for that is not quite clear.
In part four of this series, the payoff, how much pork barrel money is coming into the state of Oregon, and how is it taking away from real economic development? For KBOO News, Stephanie Potter, Rabia Yeaman, Shirley Wentworth, Lisa Loving, and Martha Odom reporting.
Craig Rosenbrock has been released from his subpoena to appear today. But he is now commanded to appear in front of the grand jury on August 17th. Because of this change, the rally scheduled for Thursday at the Eugene Federal Building has been canceled. This report, originally posted on the U.S. House of Representatives website, is no longer available.
Washington Republican State Representative Rodney Tom of Bellevue is switching parties and will challenge State Senate Republican floor leader Luke Esser this fall as a Democrat. State Republican Chairwoman Diane Tabelius immediately called on Tom to resign his House seat, saying his change of mind, in her words, demonstrates a lack of credibility and sincerity. But Tom says he intends to serve the balance of his term as a Democrat. Tom says the legislative Republicans have moved so far to the right they no longer represent the interests of mainstream voters. Democrats are welcoming Tom's switch, saying it reflects a growing disenchantment of suburban moderates with hardline Republicans. In Washington, Democrats currently control the state Senate 26-23.
In Coos Bay, more than 100 community residents gathered this week on the southwestern Oregon Community College campus to hear the news that natural gas had been discovered in Coos County. Many come to ask company representatives hard questions on the impact of natural gas production to the economy and the environment. This from Coos Bay World Link. The meeting on methane production was calm and orderly, unlike the shouting matches that characterized a meeting on concerns about the proposed liquid natural gas facility on the North Spit. The president of Methane Energy Corporation, Steve Papajohn, explained the geological characteristics of the Coos County Basin and the production methods MEC plans to use in order to help protect the environment. But Ron Sadler, an opponent of the project and a concerned community member, asked Papajohn about the effects of draining water from the coal beds and about how this saltier water would be kept from contaminating streams and freshwater aquifers. Sadler did not seem convinced by assurances that the company would use a zero discharge policy for all water on production sites, and it would not be reinjected into the ground unless MEC followed strict regulations through the Department of Environmental Quality.
Debate on a budget bill that would allow oil drilling in the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge has likely been postponed. Ross Story has learned debate is, for the time being, expected to begin today. Republicans have attached the controversial provision to a budget bill, thereby making it immune to a Democrat-led filibuster. Similar efforts have derailed or at least delayed the plan in the past. Senators John Kerry and Maria Cantwell of Washington, but strikingly, not Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon, have sponsored an amendment to the bill that would prohibit the drilling debate due to the long list of items scheduled for debate before the upcoming St. Patrick's Day break. You might want to call Senator Wyden's office. The number is at the KBOO front desk. You can get it by calling us at 503-231-8032.
The Washington Post today will publish a front-page story that begins, President Bush plans to issue a new national security strategy Thursday, reaffirming his doctrine of preemptive war against terrorists and hostile states with chemical, biological, or nuclear weapons, despite the troubled experience in Iraq. In his revised version, Bush offers no second thoughts about the preemption policy, saying it remains the same and defending it as necessary for a country in the early years of a long struggle akin to the Cold War. In a nod to critics in Europe, the document places a greater emphasis on working in concern with allies and declares a diplomacy to be our strong preference in tackling the threat of weapons of mass destruction. Bush says, if necessary, however, under long-standing principles of self-defense, we do not rule out use of force before attacks occur, even if uncertainty remains as to the time and place of the enemy's attack. Such language could be seen as provocative at a time when the United States and its European allies have brought Iran before the UN Security Council. Some security specialists criticize the continued commitment to preemption. One veteran military strategist said, a military attack against Iran, for instance, could be foolish, and it would be better to seek other ways to influence its behavior.
Senator Barbara Boxer has become the third U.S. senator to back a move to censure President Bush over the warrantless wiretapping program. She joined Senators Tom Harkin and Russ Feingold in standing up to raw power, this according to Raw Story. Boxer's office said she would support the measure. Roll Call reported that Harkin had joined Feingold in his bid to censure Bush. Most Democrats have not expressed an opinion on the move, but Senate aides have told Raw Story they were frustrated with how it was introduced and for the fact that no one was told before the motion was unveiled. Harkin told Roll Call, I think it makes sense, quite frankly. I think we ought to have a full-fledged debate on this.
House Republicans launched an election year drive yesterday to rein in political groups that operate with looser restraints than candidates and their parties. It is an attempt to blunt the activities of liberals such as billionaire George Soros. Wealthy supporters who make donations of $1 million or more to such groups could contribute no more than $30,000 under the legislation, according to Republican officials. The organizations would be subject to more frequent disclosure requirements. Republican officials said the restrictions would apply to organizations that work on both sides of the political divide. More recently, Republican strategists have expressed concern about the efforts of Soros and others to boost Democratic prospects in the congressional midterm elections. GOP leaders announced plans to fold their proposal into ethics-related bills to be brought to the full House in the wake of a corruption scandal spawned by lobbyist Jack Abramoff. Other measures would ban privately funded travel for House members at least through the end of the year and require lobbyists to disclose the gifts they make to lawmakers. Democrats who released their own ethics-related legislation earlier this year criticized the Republican proposals.
Senate Republicans cast symbolic campaign season votes yesterday to increase spending for border and port security. The action comes one day before a likely vote to increase the national debt by an additional $781 billion to $9 trillion. The uncomfortable vote to increase the debt is the fourth since President Bush took office, and it comes as Republicans struggle to pass a budget plan for next year. GOP leaders have already dropped Bush's plan for tax cuts and curbs to Medicare, but now his cap on appropriated spending is in danger as well. After the expected vote today, Democrats and moderate Republicans may succeed in adding $7 billion in spending for education and health care research to a GOP-driven plan for the budget year that begins October 1st. If the move is successful, that would break through but Bush's requested cap on the amount of money available for spending bills. The debt limit increase is an unhappy necessity. The alternative is a first-ever default on U.S. financial obligations.
The U.S. military has sent several hundred troops with tanks and other armor from Kuwait to the Baghdad area. In its first time, extra troops have been sent since December's parliamentary election, which was followed by a period of political wrangling and a wave of sectarian violence triggered by the bombing of a Shiite shrine on February 22nd. Moving an army battalion of about 700 soldiers from Kuwait is part of a broader plan dubbed Scales of Justice that includes the repositioning of several thousand U.S. and Iraqi security forces inside Iraq. The moves, which include two other army battalions, come in anticipation of potential sectarian violence related to a Shiite pilgrimage this month, marking the Arba'een religious holiday and in response to a request by the Iraqi government. The only unit added from outside Iraq is a battalion from Kuwait, which is part of the 1st Armored Division. The decision to add the armored unit from Kuwait is in contrast to the Bush administration's hopes to substantially reducing the U.S. military presence in Iraq this year. There are currently about 133,000 U.S. troops there. It comes amid Bush administration efforts to persuade the American public that the war effort is succeeding. Opinion polls show faltering public support for the war.
The Bush administration last night released the first declassified documents collected by U.S. intelligence during the Iraq War. The documents show that Saddam Hussein's regime was monitoring reports that Iraqis and Saudis were heading to Afghanistan after the September 11th attacks to fight U.S. troops. The documents, the first of thousands expected to be declassified over the next several months, were released via a Pentagon website at the direction of National Intelligence Director John Negroponte. Many were in Arabic with no English translation. The administration said one showed that Iraqi intelligence officials suspected Al-Qaeda members were inside Iraq in 2002. The release of the documents, expected to continue for months, is designed to allow lawmakers and the public to investigate what documents from Saddam's regime claimed about such controversial issues as weapons of mass destruction and Al-Qaeda in the period before the United States invaded Iraq in March of 2003. The website cautioned that the U.S. government has made no determination regarding the authenticity of the documents, validity or factual accuracy of the information contained therein, or the quality of any translations when available.
Thousands of protesters have taken to the street of Ecuador demanding an end to free trade talks with the United States. President Alfredo Palacio says he will not bow to the demands. The indigenous communities who have led the protests say a deal with the United States would harm their economy and their culture and benefit only the wealthy. The president said the protests were designed to create chaos and to lead to a coup. Ecuador is about to enter a final round of the free trade talks at the end of March. Colombia and Peru have already signed similar deals with the U.S.
According to the BBC, Libya and France have signed an accord for the peaceful use of nuclear energy. The signing took place during the visit to Tripoli by France's Director of Atomic Energy Commission, Alain Bougat. It's the first such agreement to be signed with Libya since the country gave up its nuclear ambitions for military use more than 2 years ago. The supervisor of Libya's National Center for Nuclear Research and Development, Matouf Mohamed Matouf, says the accord is an important milestone in Libya's relations with the rest of the world. Matouf says they are looking to use nuclear energy for water desalination plants to meet the country's projected water shortage in 15 years. Other civil nuclear power uses envisioned include agriculture and solar energy. Tripoli sees the nuclear accord as a significant step by the West, led by France. More importantly, this latest development symbolizes a new era of trust between Libya and the international community.
At least 300 small-scale farmers have taken over a Swiss-owned experimental farm in southern Brazil, saying it is pushing farmers off land and destroying the environment. The activists from the landless movement say the occupation is part of a plan to target multinational agribusiness. They accuse the experimental farm of sowing genetically modified seeds close to a nature reserve. They have also occupied dozens of farms and cattle ranches to press for land reform.
Saddam Hussein testified yesterday for the first time in his trial. He called on Iraqis to stop killing each other and instead fight U.S. troops. The judge reprimanded him for making a rambling political speech and ordered the TV cameras switched off. Saddam began his speech by declaring he was the elected president, touching off a shouting match with Chief Judge Rauf Abdelrahman. Abdelrahman told him, "You used to be a head of state, you're a defendant now." Abdelrahman shouted at him again and closed the session for 90 minutes, ordering journalists out of the room and delayed broadcast cut while Saddam finished reading his speech. The trial of Saddam Hussein is adjourned for another 3 weeks after the former leader refused to answer questions. Prosecutors will have another chance to try to question Saddam on the charges when the trial reconvenes on April 5th.
Pro-union workers at the Oregon State Lottery hope the third time is a charm, and they're not talking about Powerball tickets. Union supporters formally requested an election Tuesday to authorize Local 503 of Service Employees International Union to represent them in collective bargaining. The SEIU submitted cards to the State Employment Relations Board, signed by more than 30% of affected lottery workers requesting the election. The move came after two failed drives by Oregon's largest state workers union to win streamlined recognition and at the lottery without a formal election. That process, which requires cards signed by an outright majority of workers, fizzled after a handful of workers retracted their cards. The Oregon State Lottery is one of the few sizable state agencies that aren't unionized. Because it primarily is a sales organization, it has more leeway to operate like a business. It conducts its collective bargaining separate from other state agencies. The lottery uses an incentive-based pay system akin to a private sector model. Lottery officials say it boosts worker productivity. Some workers like it because they can get more pay if they exceed performance targets set by managers. Others say the system isn't applied fairly. This from the Salem Statesman Journal.
David Portoti lost his oldest brother, Jim, when an airplane hijacked by terrorists smashed into the World Trade Center on 9/11. A month later, Portoti says he began drawing federal scrutiny by being photographed and videotaped as he waved a banner in opposition to the U.S. bombing of Afghanistan. Now, as director of September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows, Portoti wants the FBI to admit it has been spying on him and others who openly exhibit opposition to U.S. domestic and foreign policy. The New York Civil Liberties Union filed Freedom of Information request this week, asking the FBI to come clean on behalf of 14 prominent political and religious groups around the state. Officials say they believe there are scores of others. At the same time, the New York ACLU is submitting papers to the federal government's Joint Terrorism Task Force. American Civil Libertarians in Pennsylvania were releasing data they got by a Freedom of Information Act that confirmed the FBI is spying on the pacifist Thomas Merton Center in Pittsburgh. The revelations came during Sunshine Week, which focuses on the public's right to know and keep its government accountable. Corey Stratton, the New York ACLU staff attorney, said today's request will pull back the veil of secrecy that the National Security Agency, the Defense Department of Defense, and the FBI have used to hide unlawful surveillance. NYCLU Executive Director Donna Lieberman said a list would stretch on for pages if she had to name all the agencies across New York that believe they've been spied upon. Included on Tuesday's FOIL request are animal rights activists, there's a Quaker Action Committee, Parents and Veterans for Peace, and the Statewide Council for American Islamic Relations. This according to the Albany Times Constitution. And there you have it. This has been the KBOO Morning News for Thursday, March 16, 2006. Weather for today calls for rain with highs 45 to 50. Tonight showers likely, lows 35 to 40. You are listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA. Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producer for this morning's newscast is Kathleen Stevenson and Chris Andre. Our assistant producer is, that was Kathleen Stevenson. Special thanks to evening news reporters who contributed stories. Our engineer is Boone Reavis. The KBOO Morning News and Public Affairs Director is Kathleen Stevenson. I'm Chris Andre.
And I'm Carlos Chavez.
Stay tuned. We've got a lot more coming up this morning for you on your community radio station.